fortunate composers whose lifetime of struggle and stress, of triumphs and failures, are reduced to a single piece. Find out more about their lives, hear their famous hits and some of their other music on Composer of the Week with me, Donald MacLeod, this Monday to Friday at noon on Radio 3 and BBC Sounds.
It's midday, time for Private Passions, and Michael Barclay's guest is the world expert on birds, Professor Tim Birkhead.
We celebrate spring today and the music of birdsong with one of the world's leading experts on birds, Professor Tim Birkhead. An award-winning scientist, author and university lecturer, he's Emeritus Professor of Zoology at the University of Sheffield and the author of many books which communicate his own lifelong passion, including What It's Like to Be a Bird and, most recently, Birds and Us, a 12,000-year history of our relationship with birds, from cave art to conservation. Your music today, Tim, is a delight. I think you must have had great fun making this list, choosing music inspired by birdsong.
I have indeed. It was a great challenge, and it made me kind of search my memories as well for pieces of music from the past I'd been inspired by.
Before we start on the human music, which is to say Mozart, Beethoven, Josquin des Prez, let's hear just a snatch of the music of birds. Now, Chaucer said that birds in spring sing with the voices of angels, and there is something otherworldly about the beauty of the dawn chorus, isn't there?
I love the dawn chorus. I love the emergence of spring. We've had a long, cold, silent winter, and suddenly the birds start singing. When I was a teenager, my dad had a Grundig tape recorder, and I would get up at 4 a.m, hang the microphone out of the window simply to record the dawn chorus, and then I would play it back to myself later in the day. And of course, these days, the dawn chorus is very impoverished. So this recording that we're going to hear is from an area rich in birds, and it is truly inspirational.
Why have you decided to follow the dawn chorus with the old Catalan carol, Song of the Birds?
I love this piece of music because in the written version, there's a lot of different verses, each one about a different species of bird. And although we haven't heard the words of that, I just think the cello is the closest sound to bird song, and I just love the passion with which this piece is played.
Well, we'll hear it played by Pablo Casals, but first we're going to have that dawn chorus recorded in the Forest of Dean by the naturalist Jeff Sample.
Thank you.
Song of the Birds, played by Pablo Casals, who was accompanied by the Prades Festival Orchestra in his own arrangement. If we could translate birdsong into our much inferior human language, Tim Burkhead, what kind of lyrics do you think the birds would be singing?
They'd be singing two types of lyrics. First, they would be singing, "Keep out, this is my patch, this is my territory." Most bird song is uttered by males. Females do sing in certain species, but predominantly it is males, and males are defending a territory because the territory contains the resources, the food supply, the nest site and so on that the female needs. The other message that they're giving is, "I'm available." And so male birds sing to announce their availability to potential mates. Of course, it isn't straightforward for males. The female will visit several males in succession, and she's very choosy, and she will only take one after he's performed accordingly.
And you've said the bullfinch is the ultimate songbird. Why is that?
It's the ultimate songbird to me. Natural song is actually very disappointing, but the bullfinch has this extraordinary ability to mimic other sounds, particularly tunes whistled to it by a human owner. Now, all birds, male birds, pick up their song by listening to usually their father or another male. But in the 1500s, people recognised that bullfinches were exceptionally talented. And so people took young bullfinches from the nest and hand-reared them, whistling, this happened in Germany, whistling to them a German folk song two or three times every day for 4 or 5 months. It was a long, drawn-out process. And the hope was that at the end of that period, some of the birds, and mainly the males, but sometimes the females, would be able to replicate those tunes. And this gave us an incredible insight, I think, into what was going on in the bullfinch's brain.
Well, let's hear the bullfinch, since you are so keen on him. This is him learning a human song from his trainer, who's whistling to him. But first, the sound of the bullfinch. Now the recording of the trainer whistling to the bullfinch.
Ja, halten Sie mir mal vor, Herr Müller.
And has the bullfinch learned the tune? Let's find out. That's quite extraordinary, Tim. I don't think I'd have believed it if I didn't trust you. Because the bullfinch has learnt the whole tune, improved it in some ways, moved it up a tone and neatened the structure.
That is the essence. That is the magic of the bullfinch's ability. They always move it up, semitone or a tone, and you're absolutely right. They improve on it. It's as though they have in their heads an idea of how this tune should be structured. And where the trainer is kind of pausing for breath or sounding a bit kind of lispy, the bullfinch just filters all that out and does a much more accomplished performance. It is, I mean, I'm just blown away by it. It's extraordinary.
So, I mean, basically, they almost act like our editor, indeed, in tidying it up, linking it up, and then, just to show how superior they are, moving it up a tone or a semitone.
Exactly. The other thing that's really remarkable about that kind of mimicry is that you can play recordings to birds. I mean, as I say, all birds learn their songs in that kind of way. If you just play a recording on its own, it's never as good. A crucial part of that process is the interaction, either with another bird in the natural world, or in this case, with their owner. And that recording was actually made by a colleague of mine, Jürgen Nikolai, and he sent me a video of him with one of his bullfinches. And you can just see they're in love with each other. The bullfinch is singing for its master, and he's in love with the bullfinch because it's doing so well. It is remarkable.
That connects in a wonderful way with our next music, which is by Mozart. written in 1784, a piano concerto, and the last movement links, I think, to a pet starling.
Yes, I mean, Mozart found this bird in a, what we would call a pet shop today, and heard it whistling a tune, which he says he composed some time earlier. So it's a bit of a mystery how the starling had heard this. Subsequently, Mozart incorporated other bits of starling music into some of his other compositions. There's another piece written, I think, in 1787 called A Musical Joke. And some people have claimed, who are experts on starling song, that they can hear some of the elements of starling song in that particular piece as well.
Well, Mozart bought the bird, didn't he? Took him home to be a family pet. Kept him for 3 years. Sadly, the starling then died. So Mozart buried him with considerable ceremony, and he wrote an epitaph for the starling, which goes, "Here rests a bird called Starling, a foolish little darling. He was still in his prime when he ran out of time."
Thank you.
I can understand Mozart's emotional connection with the starling. I once gave a public lecture on undergraduate teaching, and I wanted to bring something special to that lecture. So I asked my colleague, Lloyd Buck, if he would bring his 5 tame starlings and allow them to become part of my lecture. We had a few rehearsals in the afternoon to try to ensure that the birds would do what I wanted, which was to fly out of the wings from the lecture theatre and alight on me as I was talking. And they did it. They did it so perfectly that I was completely overcome and I couldn't get my words out. And they were perched on my head and my shoulder and were kind of twittering and singing towards me. And it really was one of the most emotional events of my life. It was phenomenal.
Well, we can understand why Mozart was so taken with the bird.
Absolutely.
The third movement of Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 17 in G, not with starling, but with soloist Mitsuko Ushida, who was also directing the Cleveland Orchestra from the keyboard. Can we go back to the beginnings, your beginnings, Tim Burkhead, when you were hatched? I'm interested to know where your lifelong passion for birds comes from.
Well, I was brought up in a house full of music. My parents were opera singers, and that was their hobby, and they met, actually, playing opposite each other in Gilbert and Sullivan's Mikado as Nanki Poo and Yum Yum in 1948. They sang with Opera North and various other things. But my dad was a sugar salesman. My mum was a stay-at-home mum. My dad was interested in birds, and I can remember at the age of about 4, him coming home from work, bearing a little bird book for my brother and myself. And so he was incredibly encouraging in my interest in birds. He didn't buy me any binoculars. He felt that I had to earn enough money to buy my own binoculars, which was a pretty tough life lesson. And I can't believe it now, but I used to go bird watching without binoculars. You know, it was very hard work. But eventually I did a paper round and was able to buy my own binoculars.
I think their dedication to their opera singing meant that you were slightly sleep deprived.
Yes, my parents had endless musical evenings, keeping my brother and I awake all night. And I think in the end that put us off that kind of music.
But your parents were quite keen for you to have music lessons.
I foolishly mentioned one day, I think I was about 7, that I'd quite like to play the violin. And the next day this violin appeared and suddenly I was horribly intimidated and I was sent off to lessons with a very stern violin teacher. And basically we didn't really get on. And the only kind thing he ever said to me in about 2 years of very painful, screechy lessons was that I had a good ear. And because I was brought up in the early 1960s and pop music was undergoing a kind of revolution, I dumped the violin and replaced it with a guitar, which I've been very keen on ever since, and I still play every day. And the great thing about a guitar is you can take it very easily to remote field sites where I've often done a lot of field work. And a guitar is a good icebreaker. It's great for making contact with people.
Well, that takes us very comfortably to music by Albéniz that we're going to hear next, played by Andrés Segovia. It's Granada from the suite Española. I think you saw Segovia.
Yes, when I was an undergraduate at Newcastle, I obviously knew about Segovia and was excited to see that he was coming to Newcastle to perform. And I was slightly horrified to see that the poor old chap had to be more or less lifted onto the stage. And he just looked very kind of immobile. And then we had a very, very long pause while he waited for the coughing to stop. And it seemed to go on forever, this pause. And then he started. And it was a kind of a miraculous change. There was this rather infirm old man that could barely walk, suddenly had this extraordinary dexterity and created this wonderful music. It was a very, very moving performance. Thank you.
Granada, the first movement of the Suite Española by Albéniz. We heard André Segovia playing his own arrangement for guitar. And all the details of the choices of my guest today, Tim Burkhead, are on the Private Passions website. And if you go to Sounds, you can download hundreds of previous episodes, including, actually, a fascinating interview, Tim, with your fellow scientist Nick Davis, all about the cuckoo.
Yes, Nick and I were more or less contemporaries and did our PhDs in Oxford at the same time, and we've remained good friends ever since.
In some ways, Tim, you admit that you're a somewhat unlikely academic. You say you were, in your words, rubbish at school.
I was a slow developer, would be a kinder turn of phrase. I was a bit of a rebel. I was very keen on biology, and I was keen on art, but everything else just didn't turn me on at all. And then I got to the age of about 17 or 18, and my dad said to me, look, you know, if you don't sort this out, you're going to end up working in a cloth factory in Leeds, which is what Leeds was famous for. And suddenly the horror of that arrived in my brain. I thought, okay, I better pull my socks up. And I did, and I found that I loved learning, and that has helped, obviously, to shape the rest of my career.
The scientific research which made your reputation was based on close observation of guillemots on the uninhabited island of Skomer off the coast of Wales. And I think you've been going there for about 50 years now. And what you've discovered is just how promiscuous the birds are.
Well, that's one of the characteristics of guillemots. I mean, the main aim of that study in recent years has been really conservation. But when I was doing my PhD in the 1970s, I was intrigued by their promiscuity. And I'd been inspired as an undergraduate by some research, it seems unlikely, on something called the yellow dung fly. And if you're walking in the fields in the summer, these are the yellow flies that sit on cowpats. And a colleague now, Jeff Parker, who was at Liverpool University, had discovered that these flies were actually fairly promiscuous. And I remember in the undergraduate lecture hearing about this work and thinking, I wonder if that's true in birds. And everybody said, oh, don't be ridiculous, that's a waste of time. Everybody knows birds are monogamous. And luckily for me, and I pursued that idea, they are not monogamous. So even though lots of birds pair up and males and females work together to rear the offspring, it's fairly common for both partners actually to go off and have a mating with somebody else. And that's been the focus of my research over the years, and trying to understand what the benefit can be of that promiscuity despite having a monogamous mating system. Now, for males, it's fairly clear. If you're promiscuous, you can produce additional offspring. But the real puzzle is why females are promiscuous. They're not going to generally produce any more offspring. But one of the ideas is that they might actually produce better quality offspring. So you pair up with, if you're a female, you pair up with Mr. Average, but then you have a sneaky mating with Mr. Fantastic, who lives in the next door territory.
I don't want to link the subject we've just been talking about, promiscuity versus monogamy, with my next question, but it was while you were on a field trip to a supposedly uninhabited island that you met your wife.
Okay, so the day after I finished my last exam, finals, I went down to Skomer in 1972 and fell in love with the place instantly, fell in love with guillemots, and then a few months later fell in love with my wife, who I met there, and she was on a field course.
You went on to a job in the Canadian Arctic, watching Arctic seabirds, and I think that takes us to our next music, doesn't it?
It does. But it was a slightly difficult time for me because I'd just got engaged to my future wife, and the guy who ran the project kept adding on extra months of fieldwork. And I ended up feeling a little bit homesick, and this Beethoven piece was on a cassette that I'd taken. And I got a little cassette player and half a dozen cassettes. And this was one of my favourite pieces. I felt a little bit homesick, and I played this, and it always made me feel better, and I still enjoy listening to it.
Music from the first movement of Beethoven's Piano Sonata No. 17 in D minor, The Tempest. We heard Daniel Barenboim in his recording from 2020. I can't help wondering, Tim, the Tempest Sonata makes me think about the possible impact of the recent storms we've been having this year on birds. What kind of effect do you think they have had?
I think that the recent storms might well result in what we call a wreck, a seabird wreck. Certainly this happened in 2014 when we had three storms in rapid succession and a huge number, 50,000 guillemots and puffins were found washed up, emaciated on various beaches on the west coast of Britain and different parts of Europe. We don't really know exactly why this happens. Obviously, they're struggling to find enough food during these stormy conditions. But the really worrying thing is that storms like this are becoming increasingly frequent and they're more intense than they have been in the past. And last year on SCOMA, there were storms during the breeding season, which is almost unprecedented. And as a result of that, the birds' breeding success, the number of chicks that they produced, was lower than at any other time in the 50-odd years that I've been studying guillemots on SCOMA. And if that's going to happen in the future, seabirds are going to be having a difficult time. And certainly further north in Britain and Europe, climate change has had a devastating effect on puffin and guillemot populations, which have crashed to almost nothing in some places. So this is a worrying time for birds.
When you came to write the history of our relationship with birds recently, you had to grapple with some very painful truths because, of course, for centuries, men have been trapping and killing birds for sport, for food. And in fact, the Italian Renaissance is very connected to this problem, isn't it? And so this music, Scaramella by Josquin, I imagine sums up that period for you.
It does indeed. And people have exploited birds, mainly as a source of food, for centuries, for millennia, in fact. And this particular piece of music was one that we played in the car when I visited Italy to look at some ancient bird-catching structures called roccoli. These are rather extraordinary structures. It's a double-rowed hedge, circular, about 60 feet in diameter, in the past, it would have had a net between the two rows of hedges. And hanging on the inner hedge, there would have been little cages with birds singing. And these songbirds would have lured in passing migrants. And in fact, these roccoli were all positioned on the migration routes on the southern side of the Alps. And as the birds came in, were lured in, a man inside the roccoli would throw out a wooden disc that the birds would think was a predator, and they would dive for cover. And of course, they would dive into the nets and were captured. And my interest in the history of ornithology included this relentless exploitation of birds, which really, still goes on in the Mediterranean countries today. They don't use roccoli, they use bird lime or glue to catch huge numbers, millions of migrant warblers and so on, just to eat, and they're very expensive in restaurants. So it's a good source of income to people, but not something you want to hear if you're concerned by the conservation of birds.
So this is the music that you were playing and listening to at that time. Scaramella by Josquin des Prez.
I love this piece. The woman singing sounds a little bit bird-like to me. I love the sound of the gentle lute. It's just a beautiful piece.
Thank you.
Shirley Rumsey was both the lutenist and the vocalist in Scaramella by Josquin des Prez. One of your books, Tim, has the wonderful title, What's It Like to Be a Bird? And I can't resist asking you about that. For a start, of course, we'd all love to be able to fly, but we'd have much better hearing and eyesight, wouldn't we? Because you had an extraordinary experience when you realised how a guillemot can spot its mate even far out at sea.
I was sitting in a hide that I'd made very close to a group of breeding guillemots, just a couple of metres away. It was wonderful because you felt as though you were part of the colony. And I'd been watching guillemots for some time. I was interested in their behaviour, and I felt as though I'd got a good handle on their behaviour, when suddenly a bird that was incubating its egg just in front of me stood up and started to give its greeting call. And I thought to myself, this is very odd. They normally only ever do this when their partner has arrived. And I looked out to sea, and there were lots of birds flying backwards and forwards, but I could see one bird about 700 metres away flying towards the colony. And to my utter amazement, a few seconds later, it landed beside this bird, and then they did go through their mutual greeting ceremony. And it made me realise that this bird, who'd stood up off its egg, had recognised its partner all that way away. It went to me, even with binoculars, it just looked like a brown blob. And suddenly my perception of the way birds, and guillemots in particular, perceived the world was transformed by this. And that was the inspiration for writing that book, What It's Like to Be a Bird.
What do they do when they greet each other, guillemots?
They're very vocal. Guillemot colonies are very loud places, very dirty and smelly as well, but they basically clash their beaks, open beaks together whilst they're making this rather loud yodeling sound. And the bird itself is brown on its back, white underneath, but inside the mouth it's kind of bright orange. So it's also a bit of a visual display as well. And in the winter, when I can't get to Scomer, I often go to Bempton Cliffs on the Flamborough Headland simply to get a guillemot fix so I can hear them doing those kind of greeting calls.
How do your family react to your dedication to guillemots and their being deprived of their own bird?
I think they have been very tolerant. I think I did manage to put all my three children off becoming bird enthusiasts. I mean, they're very knowledgeable. They've picked up quite a lot. And I remember on one occasion when I was being interviewed on Radio Sheffield about some of the work I'd done on promiscuity, the female interviewer said to me, she looked at me in dismay. She said, what do your children think about you doing all this research on promiscuity? And I went, oh, they love it. You know, and she was horrified because people still find it difficult to talk about those aspects of reproduction. But my family are entirely used to it.
Well, we're going to hear next a very famous recording from the BBC archive. This is Beatrice Harrison playing the cello in her garden to a nightingale, recorded in May of 1924. It's become one of the most celebrated live recordings of all time, as she waits for the nightingale to answer the cello with its own song. But the reason you've chosen this is?
I love this story. So Beatrice Harrison would play her cello in her garden on a summer's evening, and she was thrilled when a local nightingale accompanied her. Somebody got to hear about this in the BBC and thought this would make a wonderful live recording. And so in 1924, this is what happened, and all the recording equipment was moved into the garden and into the woodland. The programme was an hour long. It was going to start at 9 o'clock, and off she went. So she's playing Danny Boy. And we wait and we wait and we wait, and it gets to literally something like 2 minutes to ten, 2 minutes before the end of the hour, and suddenly the nightingale bursts into song. And the effect, I mean, is still an incredibly powerful effect, and this duet between her and the nightingale. And 10 o'clock comes, the programme ends, and it receives a rapturous response. She got thousands of fan letters in the next few days, and the BBC decided that they would repeat the performance each year after that, and that's what they did. But in fact, it isn't a nightingale, I'm afraid, it's a person.
Well, what do you mean by that? Because this is quite a shocking answer for some people.
This was, as you say, one of the most famous recordings, and the BBC had set up all the recording equipment in the garden earlier in the day, and I think knowing that they might have disturbed the nightingale, they arranged to have a person who could mimic a nightingale, or called a siffleur, a professional whistler, it was a woman, ready in the wings. It was Madame Sabron. She was a professional bird mimic, and I think she appeared on the stage, and that was her career, mimicking the songs of birds, and she did it extremely well, because the nightingale's song is one of the most difficult ones for a human to mimic.
This is going to come as something of a shock to many people who are very devoted to this story and the sound. Can you see that they're going to say, are you sure about this?
So, yes, research by various colleagues of mine had demonstrated that she had been employed by the BBC to stand in case the nightingale did not sing. But as I say, that was a kind of fail-safe for the BBC, and in subsequent years they set up the equipment in a more subtle kind of way, and the nightingale did indeed perform. So the subsequent ones, in the subsequent years, were all genuine nightingales.
Well, I think I should say that nowadays there are quite strict rules about what the BBC can put out, and you cannot fake things like this. But it was broadcast live, and here's a recording from that broadcast of 1924. I don't think I'll ever listen to it in quite the same way again.
No, you have to listen to the subsequent years.
Yes.
When you get the real thing.
Do you think a real nightingale with its superior hearing would be fooled by the recording?
That's a very good question. That would be a very interesting experiment to undertake to see whether it worked.
Have you ever tried playing music to birds, Tim?
Not directly. I haven't played the guitar to birds, but I've played, a CD player to birds, and they all burst into song. And I actually know what's kind of going on in my brain when I do that, because in about 2009, I had the opportunity to explore this with a psychologist, an American called Larry Parsons. And what we did was to try to look at what was happening inside the human brain when listening to birdsong. We did this using an MRI scanner. And I was interested in whether our interest and emotional response to birdsong was hardwired. So what we did was we had three subjects. There was myself, there was Larry, and there was an undergraduate. The undergraduate claimed to have no interest in birdsong or music. Larry was interested only in music and knew nothing about birds, and I had an interest in both. So the student goes into the scanner and comes out, and Larry says, well, there's not much brain activity going on there. There wasn't much of a response. And we were each played a mixture of white noise, classical music, and I think it was Robin's song. He goes into the scanner and bits of his brain light up because he's interested in music. But when I came out of the scanner, he looked at me in amazement and said in his American accent, your whole freaking brain lit up. And what that suggests to me is that our love of birdsong is not hardwired, but it's kind of culturally acquired. Not that that takes anything away from it, but I thought that was a bit revealing, admittedly on a very small sample size of subjects.
Well, my brain was actually lighting up just listening to that story, and it certainly lights up when I hear birds here in Wales. But we're in fact going to the Arctic next for our final piece. We're going to play out on the saxophonist Jan Garbarek from his jazz album I Took Up the Runes. And this uses an ancient Sami song, His Eyes Were Suns. A track to remind you of your time watching seabirds in the Arctic.
Yes, I spent a lot of time in the Canadian Arctic watching Brunix guillemots, and I love here the interaction between this simple chanting, probably shamanistic song, and Garbarek's modern take on it with the saxophone. I just love the mixture of these two things. I think it works extremely well.
Well, as we listen to this version of an ancient folk song from the far north, it only remains for me, Tim Burkhead, to say thank you for a fascinating conversation today.
It's been my pleasure, and I wish I could whistle back in return to mimic a bullfinch. I wish I could mimic a guillemot. That would be much more exciting.
Saxophonist Jan Garbarek in His Eyes Were Suns, a track from his 1990 album I Took Up the Runes. The vocalist was Ingvar Antar Eilu Gob. And that was the final choice of Michael Barclay's guest on Private Passions today, Tim Burkhead. The episode was produced by Elizabeth Burke, and it was a Loftus Media production for BBC Radio 3. As ever, you can find details of all of the music in the programme if you search for Private Passions on BBC Sounds. And while you're there, you can also download hundreds of previous editions. Private Passions returns next Sunday at noon when Michael Barclay will be in conversation with the orthopaedic surgeon Dame Claire Marks. This is BBC Radio 3 on 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio, online and on BBC Sounds. In a couple of minutes, today's lunchtime concert, but now at 1 o'clock, the latest BBC News read by me, John Shea. The Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, has criticised the government's plan to send some asylum seekers to Rwanda, saying it was the opposite to the nature of God. In an Easter Sunday sermon, he said there were serious ethical questions about the scheme. The Home Secretary, Priti Patel, has said she expects other countries to follow the UK's blueprint and that the approach will save lives and stop migrants turning to people traffickers. An exchange of letters published by the Home Office has outlined the concerns of the department's top civil servant about the viability of the plan to send asylum seekers to Rwanda. The Permanent Secretary, Matthew Rycroft, said there was not sufficient evidence to show that the scheme would deter migrants from attempting to cross the English Channel. Priti Patel said she was confident it was the best chance at making that happen. There's been no sign of the last Ukrainian troops in the city of Mariupol responding to a Russian ultimatum to lay down their arms. The Kremlin said the Russian military would not kill fighters who surrendered this morning. Ukraine's deputy prime minister has demanded that Russian forces open humanitarian corridors from Mariupol to allow citizens and wounded Ukrainian troops to be brought out. Pope Francis has criticised the Russian invasion, saying Ukraine had been dragged into a cruel and senseless war. In his traditional Urbi et Orbi message at the Vatican, the Pope said it was an Easter of war and the fighting in Ukraine should make people more concerned about other conflicts around the world. The military rulers of Myanmar say they're releasing 1,600 prisoners to mark the Buddhist New Year. But reports suggest far fewer people than normal have been pardoned and that those imprisoned for protesting against the army coup last year will remain in jail. There's been a third night of unrest in Sweden over rallies by the far-right anti-immigrant group Stram Kurs, which has burned a copy of the Quran and has threatened to burn more. Violence broke out in the southern city of Malmö, where cars and a bus were set on fire and some protesters threw stones at the police. The mother and baby retailer Jojo Maman Bébé is being sold to the fashion chain Next and a group of finance firms. It'll stay as an independent brand, but it will now use Next's infrastructure, such as its online software. It says stores which are profitable will remain open. And the weather. It'll turn cloudy and wet across western parts of the UK as a band of rain moves in. Eastern areas will stay dry with plenty of sunshine. And that's the news and weather on BBC Radio 3 at very nearly 3 minutes past one.
Radio 3 presents the acclaimed...